You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for August 16th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the vanguard of the Ted Cruz birth certificate search party, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
And we got to find the long form, too.
Yeah, the long form. None of this short
Canadian
form
long form. Yeah.
It has to be as long as a T-Bog comment section. Or it don't count.
You know what? Someone sent us a donation this week to also do a Rand Paul gift birth certificate.
Yeah, so, I think that's only fair.
Yeah, I think we ought to have long-form birth certificates for all the Republicans. And they, if they're not American, forget it.
Remember, no matter the amount of proof, it's not enough. That's just the rule.
That's just the rule.
Just how we roll here. And as I don't want to skip ahead in our notes here because we're actually cramming this in.
We are, because today was the first day of school for one child. The others start school next week. We kick them all up to bed tonight. It's Thursday night. It's the last night of John Oliver's on Daily Show, which we want to watch live or watch when it's on.
And it's
9:35 on.
And they just got home a couple of days ago.
They just got home Monday night. Yeah, 2 a.m. The girls did. So, yeah. Thank you, Amtrak. But you got them home safely, but very late.
So we've been sort of running on fumes for the last couple of days. So
we love you guys. And thanks for all your notes and contributions and all that good stuff. We just are so appreciative.
These are explanations, not alibis.
Not alibis.
No.
I want to start tonight's podcast by talking about David Brooks. Can you believe it?
Okay, fine. You know how much I hate talking about David Brooks, but please proceed. By the way, the New York Times has the four happiest words in the English vocabulary on their print edition tonight.
Which is?
David Brooks is off today. But please.
That's five words. Anyway.
Damn it. I had to count on my fingers. Yeah.
10 grain at Mock Paper Scissors.
I think of David Brooks as one word, so.
Okay.
Please.
Peggy Noonan is owned and trademarked by 10 grain at Mock Paper Scissors. We want to acknowledge that. He owns Peggy Noonan. Mm-hmm. But as he said, you know, there must have been a 2-for-1 sale on Captain Morgan this week. And the pineapple truck came in because she
she lost it.
Went off the rails, talking about the rodeo clown and how Obama really ought to embrace that rodeo clown and show what a wonderful person and a forgiving and magnanimous person he can be toward the rodeo clown who wore an Obama mask to work.
And of course, in her most brash, half in the bag voice, but will Obama do that? No, of course not. He's not that kind of guy.
And then she took another swig of her Mai Tai. And
and her intern just took it all down.
Her tumbler's full of regret. Yes. All right. Then Richard Cohen got all butt hurt because Hillary Clinton isn't doing enough Iowa picnics yet. And she doesn't have a theme to her campaign except that she's a woman. That's it. That's her theme. And Driftglass, what year is it?
I am not sure anymore.
It's 2014.
I used to know. I really used to know.
Apparently, she's not doing enough Iowa picnics to satisfy Richard Cohen in August of 2014.
Nobody can.
But that's okay, because you know what? Jennifer Rubin isn't worried.
No.
She knows the brightest political future belongs to John Bolton.
Yeah.
And he's probably going to run for president, too, according to Jennifer Rubin.
He probably will, birth certificate and all. He'll just show up one day and say, I'm your president. Yeah.
And so my point is that this David Brooks on Sunday was celebrating the fact that the sale of the Washington Post to Jeff Bezos means we're going to return to authority and not listen to those junior high bloggers anymore.
Yeah.
And these are the authorities we're going to turn to, apparently.
Yeah. The Sunday morning public interest programming that I refer to as the mouse circus has become such a catastrophe.
Well, apparently Meet the Press is now at the bottom of the Sunday morning ratings.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's
great
bad.
Great news for Chuck Todd.
Yeah. Yeah. John McCain just couldn't be happy. But it remains a place where you can go and be taken seriously by
people who can be taken seriously at the moment he wants to be. Yes, absolutely.
And And the problem with the Sunday shows is I've been writing about them now for 8 years. And recently a lot of other people have gotten into that business, and that's a good thing. But they really do defy criticism.
Just like Jennifer Rubin.
Because it's not that they're bad. It's they're bad every week, and they're really kind of amazingly bad every week.
Well, it is Jennifer Rubin. I thought about that today when I was reading about the former ombudsman of the Washington Post, who probably was under a contractual agreement not to say this in public while he had his job.
Yeah.
But he sent an open letter to the editor-in-chief or the editors of the Washington Post saying, fire Jennifer Rubin. She's just awful.
Yeah.
Now they're and,
there anymore. Yeah.
You know, she's not even a good conservative. She's just not, there's nothing about her that contributes to the newspaper. Really not sugarcoating at all. His criticism and her response was, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah.
And that's a direct quote, by the way. She said, that's a direct quote. Ha, 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 ha. She's just impervious. She's not there to be good. She's there to be
Jennifer Rubin. Yeah.
So, and that's what the Sunday shows are.
Yeah.
They aren't there to be good or fair or good journalism.
No.
Or reporting. They're there to fill a Sunday morning time slot for sponsors of the military industrial complex.
And the energy industry.
And the energy.
Yeah. Don't leave them out.
And agribusiness, agribusiness, and that's it.
And boner pills. Don't forget the boner pills.
Oh, God,
very important.
Boner pills, yeah.
But yeah, David Brooks sat down and quite legitimately said that blogging is basically over, that he used to read it, but then he'd get all excited about some blog, and then he'd find it was some 12-year-old who had to leave for junior high school, and oh, wasn't that funny that he said that? And that we're going to return to quality people, you know, quality people like David Brooks, and the authority of those quality people that we can trust. And you know, there really was this brief interregnum when everyone realized that people like David Brooks and Jennifer Rubens,
and Richard Cohen, who's a worse writer than even Jennifer Rubin, I think.
And there's an awfully long list. Tom Friedman. And the list just goes on. Andrew Sullivan, I would add to that pile too, are just awful. And their awfulness,
Sullivan can write a sentence.
Yeah, he can. That's true.
And I don't think that Tom Friedman actually can put together a cohesive three paragraphs and follow without it, you know, having to interject that his cab driver said he was awesome.
And that's why he's on the Pulitzer Committee. Huh?
Yeah.
But those people were all wrong in a huge way about economics, especially
just about the war. If we only talk about the Iraq War and nothing else.
Well, but I'm going to stick to David Brooks. David Brooks was hugely wrong about the Iraq War and the Bush tax cuts and the deficits and the Democrats and George Bush reforming the GOP and the competence of the Republican Party and on and on and on and on. He's been wrong about everything. And there was a moment there, a brief, terrifying moment when people started to say, hey, have you noticed that David Brooks is completely fucking wrong about everything? And that was a very dangerous period. That was the Air America period. That was when bloggers were rising up against those quality people of authority and saying, but you got everything wrong. It doesn't matter how well-intentioned you are. It doesn't matter how quiet and how pretty your ties are and how sort of soft-spoken you are and how much everyone loves you and how Mark Shields is willing to give you a reach around on PBS every week. None of that matters. You've been really horribly, grossly wrong about a lot of shit for a long time. And apparently we're at the end of that time now because T-Bog is quitting. Mm-hmm. Steve Gilliard died. Doug Hasrali has passed away. The angry, righteous voices of the blogosphere have sort of, you know, they just had to wait them out. Mm-hmm. And now they have. And now David Brooks can go right back on the air, go right back to the New York Times and write drivel that's just awful. But nobody's going to call him out on it. There was that moment there where they heard the ice cracking beneath them. And there was a real risk that their hegemony over the media would collapse and people would start to ask really embarrassing questions like, tell me again why the fuck David Gregory is not making porn somewhere in South America. Why the hell is this guy on television at all? And those questions bubbled up almost to the point where they made a difference. And now David Brooks can go wherever he wants and talk about whatever he wants and drivel away and go to Yale and get be professor of humility. And it doesn't matter because he is completely beyond the reach of critics. And the age of blogging, the age of those 12-year-old junior high students, he can now mock them in the rearview mirror because he has a job for life. and we don't. And that's the way it goes.
I'm going to go all Bible bitch on you now.
Please do.
And I read this earlier today. 2 Corinthians 6, and I don't often read Paul because Bible bitch isn't that crazy about Paul. But this is a letter to the Corinthians encouraging the church. And I read it this morning and I thought, oh, this is podcastable. It's about staying at our post.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Companions, as we are in this work with you, we beg you, please don't squander one bit of this marvelous life God has given us. God reminds us, I heard your call in the nick of time. The day you needed me, I was there to help. Well, now is the right time to listen, the day to be helped. Don't put it off. Don't frustrate God's work by showing up late, throwing a question mark over everything we're doing. Our work as God's servants gets validated or not in the details. People are watching us as we stay at our post, alertingly, unswervingly, in hard times, tough times, bad times. When we're beaten up, jailed, and mobbed, working hard, working late, working without eating, with pure heart, clear head, steady hand, in gentleness, holiness, and honest love. When we're telling the truth, and when God's showing his power, when we're doing our best, setting things right, when we're praised, when we're blamed, slandered, and honored, true to our word, though distrusted, ignored by the world, recognized by God, terrifically alive, though rumored to be dead, beaten within an inch of our lives, but refusing to die, immersed in tears, yet always filled with deep joy, living on handouts, yet enriching many, having nothing, having it all. Dear, dear Corinthians, I can't tell you how much I long for you to enter this wide open, spacious life. We didn't fence you in. The smallness you feel comes from within you. Your lives aren't small, but you're living them in a small way. I'm speaking as plainly as I can and with great affection. Open up your lives. Live openly and expansively. We'll leave it at that.
That's very nice.
Yeah. And I think we have to listen for what the right steps are to take and what the right battles are to fight. And for me, the right battles to fight are against the war on women and against the war on black voters. And those are two things.
That voters generally, I'd say, but yeah.
And voters generally, yes. Yeah. But the war on black voters in specifics is really pretty bad.
Yeah.
And we know that from North Carolina this week.
Well, and it's easy to get frustrated. I get frustrated a lot by the immovability of some of the people in our landscape.
Well, but I, you know what I find fascinating is how bad things are over at Fox News right now.
Ah, that's true.
You know who's moving? Sean Hannity's moving out of primetime.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but he's been replaced by who?
Megyn Kelly.
Yeah. Okay.
And
Blonde Sean. So,
Blonde Sean.
Yeah.
But there's an outfit, hat tip, 10 grain and Wonkette as well for this. There's a, one of these 501c3 fundraising places called America's Survival Incorporated.
Yeah. LLC.
They're mad. They're mad about the whole Megyn Kelly thing. Pushing Sean Hannity out of the 9 p.m. slot to make way for pro-homosexual advocate Megyn Kelly is another sign of the channel's leftward drift and decline.
Yeah, that's so true. I watch Fox now just bathe in the socialism. I just bathe in the Marxist dialectic coming off my television.
Socialism. Talk to me about Cory Booker. He won this week.
Let me say one quick thing about...
Talk a little bit more about T-Bog.
Well, David Brooks and Andrew Sullivan. I told Mr. Charlie Pierce...
T-Bog, by the way.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I miss that bastard. I told Mr. Charlie Pierce today that the arc of Mr. Sullivan's career, and I would say David Brooks's career, as a very famous conservative public intellectual, is worthy of study by future generations that don't actually have to live with David Brooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the thing. It's going to be fascinating to study how the hell did these people stay, latched onto power so far after their sell-by date, so long after they've completely lost any shred of credibility. And a generation or two hence, I have a lot of faith future generations are going to be fascinated by Twitter. They're not. Mm-hmm. They're going to spend hours poring over, threads on Eschaton looking for wisdom. Your future generations, don't bother. It's not there.
Rock on.
Rock on. But there will be a time when people are going to wonder, I suppose, if we all survive, if the culture survives, what the hell were these people doing running anything? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I have no answer. I hope future generations will be able to suss this out based on the historical record, but I have no idea how they do it. I assume it has something to do with money and
access. I totally compare it to ancient Rome, though, Griffglass. Yeah. Yeah. New York City is ancient Rome, and they're Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they get the power.
Yeah.
It's who they know and who they blow. That's what it is.
There was no – yeah, but Roman error was not – screw-ups were not a matter of real-time confrontation with your own past failures.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't pop up a YouTube –
yeah,
of Cicero being wrong about something
that's true.
Drive him out of power.
That's true.
I can pull any one of 100, and I have before, 100 David Brooks quotes out of the internet showing that he is just a disaster, and it doesn't matter. And the thing that is most intriguing about people like that is not their complete failure. It's the zone of silence around them.
Yeah.
It's the zone of the people around them who say, no, to just have that look like, no, we're never going to ask him that question. We are never, ever going to ask him one.
He has a picture of a dead hooker with everybody.
He does.
Apparently.
He does.
Yeah.
And there, and people like that are of interest to me. I mean, I will mention only in passing, Glenn Greenwald does some very fine reporting. He also lies.
Yeah.
Pretty flagrantly about things that you can check pretty easily that I've written about. And no one.
The liberal fact checkers will not fact check Glenn Greenwald.
No,
they won't.
No. Think Progress won't touch him with a barge pole. Chris Hayes will never ask him a question about the. He'll ask him good questions, but he'll never ask him a question about the lie he told about his own story and that he continues to tell and that he won't back off from because that's not his style. And that just creeps me out because it tells me that there's way more going on there than just factual reporting. There's something about that person that other people don't want to risk their career being mobbed by, you know, the angry.
They don't want to deal with the comment section that's going to.
So they just let it pass.
Yeah.
They let it go by. And that bothers me immensely. When your job is journalism, that shouldn't be something that you do. Right. So speaking of that, Cory Booker.
Cory Booker.
Yeah.
Who we were trying to put on a scale. On the Harold Ford Jr. scale of douchitude.
Yeah, he's in there somewhere.
He's not quite as douchey as Harold Ford Jr., but he is Wall Street.
Yeah.
And a lot of liberals have come up and said, you know, come forward and said, you know, he's obviously better than the alternative, but he's not a liberal.
No. And I
don't understand why no one listened to me say that about Barack Obama, even though I supported Barack Obama.
Right.
And would rather have him than John McCain as president. You know, I didn't vote for the McCain-Palin ticket, Driftglass. I just didn't.
You didn't?
No. That... I didn't say, screw it. Until we get a third party, I'm voting McCain-Palin.
Well, can I give you a quote from All the President's Men, the book?
Sure, sure.
Carl Bernstein voted for McGovern.
Mm-hmm.
Unenthusiastically and unhesitatingly. Then bet in the office pool that Nixon would win with 54%.
Wow.
That is a realistic assessment.
He put his money on Nixon, but he put his vote on McGovern.
Yeah, because he knew who would win. And he just couldn't. So, but that Cory Booker is one of those things that happens once every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Someone out there is not nearly progressive enough for good progressives and liberals. Mm-hmm. But that person is better than the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And that person stands a greater likelihood by an order of magnitude of winning than the next true progressive down the ticket. So the question is, what do you do?
Part of the problem, too, as we talked about last week, is money.
Yeah.
It costs as much to run a Senate campaign as it does to own a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. It's $1.35 million to run a Senate campaign. That's every 6 years. That's not just to become a senator and then you're a senator.
No, that's
to
stay.
You need to raise another $1.3 million for 6 years from now.
Yeah.
And you might as well start today because you're going to need it.
And there's a group of people who can clear that bar. And there's 99.9% of everyone else who can't.
So we're not happy with all of the Wall Street connections
that
Booker has.
No, we're very unhappy with it.
But well, I think when it comes down to, you know, would Senator Cory Booker filibuster an appointment that Barack Obama made? No, but his opponent will. So And is Cory Booker, the question I have too is Cory Booker going to vote for financial reform or not, or is he really owned by?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see.
Well, you know,
I think it's inevitable he's going to be the senator. I don't think we need to debate that.
Well, we're not debating it. But the question is, should a good progressive refuse to vote for him because he's the lesser of two evils?
I think that's a straw man. I really do.
I think it's a straw man too, but I think it's a straw man that a whole lot of people that I have who are on my team, but I have a real problem with, mm-hmm. were proposing a strategy in 2010.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Not a dime's worth of difference. Just stay at home. Barack Obama sold us out. We didn't get single payer. A lot of stuff we didn't get. Yeah. Screw him. He's not Hopi Changi. And so let's stay home. Great. Let's do that. And then 2010 rolls around and look who we get in Congress now. And it feels good and it satisfies something inside you to punish the people on your team who let you down. And
I don't think that 2010 happened just because progressives stayed at home. The whole Obama coalition stayed at home.
Yeah.
Because they didn't think, first of all, Obama didn't get out enough.
No, he didn't. No, you're right.
And he should have. And I think he's figured that out for 2014 a little bit.
But I would like the people whose strategy consists of magic freedom unicorns mm-hmm. coming down and something, something third party, something, something breaking the seventh seal, something, something progressive millennium to explain to me those little intermediate parts. Where...
I guess I must read far fewer comment sections than you do because yes. I don't see those people.
Yeah.
So,
well, anyway. That's good. I go there.
Maybe that's the junior high people that David Brooks is talking about who want a third party. I don't know.
No, let's repeat for the record. I would love a third party. I'd love a fifth party. I'd love a parliamentary system. I don't have one. I would love to be able to have a third party. And I think at a local level, third parties can do a lot of good. But at the national level, if you really believe that there is not a dime's worth of difference between the parties, and it really doesn't matter if you let Republicans win by your absence, that's fine. That's your right to believe that. But please go have a conversation with anybody with a vagina mm-hmm. or anyone who's having their voting rights stripped away from them and explain to them why you don't think their rights are important enough for you to vote for the people who will protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And then get back to me and see how that goes. So,
Driftglass, take a second and talk about the Colbert Report on Wednesday night and the mayor of Kentucky, the Kentucky town, very small Kentucky town,
well,
made us feel so good.
That was such a feel-good story.
That was a wonderful feel-good story.
I have no idea what his name was. I don't have my notes in front of me, but it was well told.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was you could see where it was going, but it was one of those. It was just a well told, well structured piece of fiction. Except it wasn't fiction. It was a little town,
the smallest town in Kentucky.
Certainly one of them. And in East Kentucky, a little Kentucky coal mining town full of rednecks and hillbillies, and
our people,
people who the left and myself included. Make fun of.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to do that. But it was just incredibly refreshing to see this story build to this crescendo of, and by the way, the mayor is gay.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor not only is gay, but he is beloved by his town. He's also the hairdresser. Not only is he gay and beloved in the abstract, but the sheriff loves them like a brother because he's seen him through all four of his marriages. And when he proposed the LGBT... fairness
doctrine, right? That you can't fire somebody or throw them out of an apartment because they're gay. And it's in the city council of this small town. The gay mayor decided to put through this ordinance that would bar discrimination based on sexual orientation.
And all these people who, if I only heard them behind a
on the surface, yes,
I would think
homophobic. Wingnut.
Yep.
Rush Limbaugh listeners.
All said, I don't have a problem with that. I don't see a problem with that. I have no idea why anybody would have a problem with that. You know,
the thing that was very touching to me too was one of the people talked a little bit about religion mm-hmm. and said, I just don't understand why God would make a gay man and then punish him for it.
Yep.
And I prayed about it and I don't know. I don't know why God would do that.
And
I don't know.
You could see him struggling with it.
And he's, I'm struggling with it.
And you could just see it in his face. He just couldn't reconcile his religion with this guy he knew.
He got, yeah. And when you have a human friend who's done good for you, and this mayor apparently had done very concrete things for the town to make the town a better place to live.
Best water system they ever had.
Yeah.
And it was such a, it made me feel so good.
Mm-hmm. It was just a wonderful story. We'll post a link, but.
You need one of those every now and then.
You do.
And it was just delightful. And it made me feel slightly ashamed about lumping people together by accent and geography.
Well, and there's been some talk about that this week. I was grateful for a column that E.J. Dionne wrote about there's been this big survey of religion and evangelicals versus political conservatives versus religious conservatives versus political liberals and so forth, and really trying to break all of this down and finding that a lot of political liberal people are actually conservative from the standpoint of going to church. I mean, that's something, you know, that doesn't surprise you, Jeff Glass.
No.
You live with one.
Absolutely.
You're excited about the Hyperloop thing.
I am.
Oh, my God.
I totally am.
But he's not going to build it. This guy who did the Tesla.
Yeah.
Hope somebody else will take on this air hockey. What is it?
Air hockey railgun Concorde.
Concorde.
Hybrid.
Combination.
Well, yeah, that's what everybody who speculates about, you know, when I like the Hyperloop because it's in the ballpark of things like Arthur Clarke's.
Yeah, it's definitely in that wheelhouse of supersonic. Predicting very fast travel.
Well, like The Fountains of Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Breathed in a space elevator and wrote a story about
it. You were telling me about the space elevator, that it actually is attached to the Earth and in orbit at the same time. And I said it. So it's like putting pickup sticks in a styrofoam ball and rotating it around. These things are stuck out of the Earth.
Yep.
And they're rigid.
You start with usually a meteor. You've moved into orbit, and you use fusion engines to build carbon monofilament, and you build downward and upward at the same time. And you have a several hundred mile high elevator, and you get into Earth orbit by taking an elevator as opposed to blasting rockets up. And I will never ever live to see such a thing, even begun in the planning stages. But it's a big idea. It's one of those big honking engineering.
It is. It is. It's
good,
like
old fashioned golden age science fiction ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, all your best science fiction writers had some way of getting from the East Coast to the West Coast really fast.
Yeah.
Ballistic rockets are something that Robert Heinlein's first story was The Roads Got a Roll, about roads that were essentially conveyor belts.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have them. Miles wide conveyor belts where you just step across and you get up to one that's running at several hundred miles an hour. So just it appeals to my desire to see human problems, at least some human problems, solved by big Hoover Dam sized engineering things. It appeals from the geek in me. Totally.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen, but it's.
Oh, I wouldn't say never. I think they're going to come up with some fast ways to move from one city to another.
Well, yeah, a maglev train or a bullet train, sure. But the idea of building a tube, pneumatic tube from New York to Cairo is probably not going to happen in my lifetime. But who knows? 100 years from now, 200 years from now, you might see the whole surface of the Earth covered with hyperloop tubes powered by solar power.
You never
run
know.
By dogs and intelligent cockroaches, for all I know. But now, which is the biggest myth, Blue Gal?
We wondered if the biggest myth was the Hyperloop or the hookup.
Yeah, apparently.
I found this very interesting because this story pulls so many threads out of things that we talk about all the time. And particularly the media glomming on to a story that's going to bring them hits on their website. And who cares if it's true? finally, there's been a study done about this whole belief that college students are just hooking up.
They're just
having, you know, they're just having casual sex and friends with benefits, and you know, that's all it is. And It's this incredibly casual sexual revolution going on right beneath our noses.
And apparently it's the fantasy of 32-year-old magazine.
Yeah, who click on those college co-eds want no strings attached sex with you. But
really?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, no, they just did surveys of college students to find out, you know, and ask some questions like, well, how many sexual partners have you had in the past 12 months? One.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
That's considerably less exciting. Turns out
something like 78% of them said one. Mm-hmm.
And then there's the slutty girl.
But... well, the outliers are always very popular on the internet, aren't they?
That's your traffic right there.
Well, but yeah, the average student really then becomes an economic story, which, again, to me, is one of the things that I always want to talk about. People get married when they are economically able to do so. Uh-huh. And when their culture is wealthy enough financially to support housing for that couple. That's tantamount to everything. Can they afford housing of their own?
And possibility of children.
That's been true since Roman times or before. And so what has changed, what this study indicates has changed, is the way that students talk about each other. They talk about how, well, we're friends and we're partners, casual partners, but they don't talk about how they're long-term mates because neither one of them knows if they will have a job when they get out of college.
Yeah. Or ever.
Or ever.
Yeah.
And so one of the researchers attributes this slight decline in people who call their partner a regular partner or spouse to the change in the age of marriage. Well, they don't change. Yeah. Which way did it change?
Yeah.
And why would that happen?
But that's not as sexy a story.
That doesn't tell me that there's a hot co-ed that wants to have no strings attached sex with me. Yeah.
Just waiting for it. Just waiting for it.
Yeah. Because I can be a friend with benefits. Uh-huh. We all know what that means.
Bow, chicky, right. Bow, bow.
Bow, chicky, yeah. Bow, wow.
No.
But I hate to switch over to Newt Gingrich, but I kind of hate
it. Oh, that hurt. I've been
thinking about Newt Gingrich a lot this week, not only because he's back in the news with a new book, but because of the way we are talking about the Republican Party. And you brought up something several podcasts ago about how Newt Gingrich did the Go Pack tapes.
Yes.
These cassette tapes that taught Republican congressmen in 1994.
How to talk.
How to talk.
Uh-huh.
And what words to use when you get in front of a microphone. Say Democrats are weak. Say Democrats are traitors. Say Democrats don't love America. They're un-American.
And just say it over.
Just say it over and over again. And you and I discussed what would happen if Democrats came in front of a microphone and every time they opened their mouth, they said, the party of stupid is at it again.
Yeah.
They're just the party of stupid. They're racist.
Uh-huh.
This is a racist, old, dying party.
Uh-huh.
And they're stupid and they're evil and they don't care about people. And it's just go on. And the problem is a lot of that would be true about House Republicans in terms of their behavior. But one of the things that came out this week with Newt trying to push this book on how if Republicans would use their smartphones more, that would help the party, you know, grow into.
Become smart, apparently.
Party. They become a modern party because you use your smartphone or your portable computer, as he likes to call it.
Yes.
And he criticized Republicans for having no new healthcare ideas when actually a large motivation in Obamacare was Newt Gingrich's motivation for his healthcare plan back when he was running against Hillary Clinton's healthcare plan, which was we should have everyone buy private insurance.
Uh-huh. No deadbeats.
No deadbeats, right. Uh-huh. 29-year-old healthy men with a job should buy insurance and not be a deadbeat when they get in the car accident.
Yep.
And that was his argument.
That was his idea.
I was thinking about that and how Newt always seems to find a way to rise to the surface of all the crap that he's said in the past when it works for him to do that. And that the problem with the Tea Party is they took those GOPAC tapes not as a Machiavellian script.
Right.
But it's fact.
Doctrine. Right.
And doctrine. You know, I don't think Newt, I think Newt was making this kind of esoteric intellectual exercise in communication with those GOPAC tapes. But a large swath of the Republican Party just took that as, and let's face it, Rush Limbaugh took that over and used it for his script for his show and so forth.
Forever,
just think of that as news.
Yeah.
That's just the news.
And that's, I mean.
And now Newt Gingrich is trying to reel it back. It's like, honey, you are like 18 years too late.
Yeah. Well, there's the, I mean, Newt Gingrich kept two sets of books.
I didn't mean to call Newt Gingrich honey.
No. No, I will not hold that against you.
Yeah, but you're, that's exactly right. He kept two sets of books. He had he had the letters that were signed in blue ink and the letters that were signed in black.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Two ideological books, one of which were for the dumbasses who needed to vote for him, and one who would and the policy stuff that he wanted to pass or get done or, you know, be president. And his followers burned the first set of books.
Yeah. No, that's really true.
They kept the cooked ones. And they've been treating all of these incredibly bad ideas and all this incredibly racist, incredibly vicious Orwellian nonsense that came out of Newt Gingrich's mouth as the party. That's the goal, to do more of that just for the sake of doing it. And this is the result, is you have a whole party that's been dumbed down to the point where Newt Gingrich sounds like an outlier and smart. And it was never supposed to be that way. I remember I've been postponing it for a long time. There was a debate that Laura Ingraham and Ralph Reed had with David Brooks and some other conservative. And there was a moment in that debate, I swear to you, I have the video stashed away. I'm going to cut just this piece out. But it was this video where essentially the David Brooks wing of the party, which is essentially the Newt Gingrich wing of the party, was pleading with Ralph Reed to put the lie back in the bottle. It's like, dude, you're giving all our shit away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we don't hang together, and this was, it's not quite a verbatim quote. It's been several months since I saw this, but it was really close to David Brooks's debating partner, who he never contradicted, said essentially, if you keep doing this, we're going to have 12 Republican parties. We're going to have the gun nut party, the racist party, the lunatic, you know, right wing economic dipshit party, the know-nothing party, the anti-science party. And I sat there going, listen to what you're saying. You're listing off scumbag category one, scumbag category two.
Yeah.
That's your party. Mm-hmm. And you molded them into an electoral force by being neoconservatives, by being Leo Strauss, by telling them a noble lie that you didn't believe at all. But you harnessed the power of their anger and their hatred and their contempt for this country and turn it into electoral power. And the problem with Gingrich and the problem with the people who followed him is they never got in on the story that this was all bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
This was all an attempt to prod a bunch of old, dying white bigots into voting Republicans for a few more years so Newt Gingrich could become president. And that then, once the dumbasses had done their job, they should shut up and go away, and then we can do our thing in government. But they took the propaganda for serious.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to make it work. And of course it can't work. No. And that's what's making them crazy. And every time it fails, the first person to point out that it hasn't worked is the first person that's run out of the party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you have this behemoth, this mindless monster with the littered bodies behind it of the David Brookses and the David Frums and Andrew Sullivans, who were all cool with it as long as everybody was in on the scam. As long as everybody understood this is just a bunch of bullshit, we tell the rednecks so we can win election. And once the rednecks woke up to that fact and threw them out, that's when they got all mad.
Yep. We had a listener write to us this week with a fascinating question. And unfortunately, the answer came right in that day's news.
Ah.
It was a question about, can you name an
instance or a issue or a situation where Democrats and Republicans are equally bad.
Uh-huh.
You know, the whole both sides, we are always about both sides don't.
Yeah.
And he this was a sincere question of, you know, aren't there situations where both parties are actually equally bad? And that was the day that Representative Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma had the crazy cat lady come to his town hall meeting with a big, huge stack of Joe Arpaio documentation about birtherism.
Uh-huh.
And he could not turn her out the door.
And he couldn't?
He did say we lost that one. You know, that the election's over and we have to move on.
But that's
as far as he would go.
The crazy cat lady came and was Barack Obama's a Kenyan born, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Joe Arpaio has found this out. And I have a 79-page document that's notarized that I want to give to you. And I'm like, no, ma'am, I really don't want to take that from you. And he the only argument he could make was the utilitarian one. Mm-hmm. We lost that election. Mm-hmm. We need to move on. But every time she was, because she wasn't going to hear about it, because election, schmo-election, he's in there illegally.
Well, then he's above the law if we just let that election go.
And what sort of weakling are you that you're not as cranked about this as I am?
No one ever talks about Barack Obama's mother.
No, they don't.
You know, none of those birthers ever mentions that she even exists.
Well, she's a woman. And they don't have
an American, and she's white.
She's a lady.
She's from Kansas.
She's a lady who had a baby, and the Republicans don't care about those kinds of things. But yeah, this guy he could only bring himself to say we lost that referendum and now we need to move on. Mm-hmm. But every time she came back at him, he said, "But I agree with you."
But I agree with you.
But I agree with you. And that's because there's not a single fucking soul left in that party who would tell that crazy bitch, "You're a nut. You are out of your fucking mind, and you need to stop listening to crazy people who keep telling you crazy things because you're crazy." Mm-hmm. No, because she's a voter.
Yeah.
And he needs her vote to win.
He needs her vote for the primary. So yeah, she will. She will primary his ass.
Yeah.
She and her ilk will push him out of the party.
Yep.
And win the primary.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's where we're a little bit different. That's where we diverge because.
But they're forming that third party, Driftglass.
I
know. Look how well it's working out for them. They're getting to be intellectually pure.
I know. Purer and purer they will get.
I mean intellectually. I meant whatever.
Ideologically pure.
Each week we post to our website and Facebook page an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's kitty is Larry. Great name.
Yeah.
Larry smiles in his sleep. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. We love hearing from you. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union's letter on the air, unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, the internet kitties sure hope that Sean Hannity finds work soon.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013. Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
A couple of very good sci-fi questions for us.
Oh, good. I love sci-fi questions.
Yeah.
Welcome to Science Fiction University, where people make me look stupid on the air, and we go ahead and edit it and publish it.
Cal wrote us.
Yeah.
And this is this is also current events. It's not just science fiction. It's current events.
Okay.
And it has to do with Orson Scott Card coming out and saying that, you know, Obama is turning urban gangs into his personal arsenal and declaring war on white America, you know, because he's crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't think that him being crazy means we have to boycott Ender's Game. We might have to boycott Ender's Game because it's a bad movie. I don't know yet.
Yeah. But. Well, I'm still reading telltale heart, even though Edgar Allan Poe had his flaws.
Yeah, see.
Shall we say.
But Cal asks, given Orson Scott Card's recent delusions about Obama, and please exclude L. Ron Hubbard, obviously.
Oh, now you're cheating. Okay.
Who was the most batshit crazy sci-fi author in real life?
I don't know. There were a clutch of them who were involved in, I'm not sure how crazy they were, but there were people like Ben Bova. I'm not calling him crazy, just so we're clear. I think Jerry Pournelle or Larry Niven, I always mix them up, who were involved in the high frontier Star Wars weapons development program.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a streak of militarism and sort of radical libertarianism that runs through science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm not sure who the crazy ones are. I'd go sort of 180 degrees around and say the craziest science fiction writer living right now is probably Spider Robinson. Because Spider Robinson has a decent, humane, Buddhist view of humanity. This shows up.
Makes him an outlier.
It totally makes him an outlier. Right. He doesn't write about, you know, body armor and blowing planets up and a post-apocalyptic hellscape where the living envy the dead.
Mm-hmm.
He writes or wrote about hard times, but he wrote about the transmutation of pain into joy and the salvation of humanity through our good hearts. And we're in a race to, you know, between our desire to destroy ourselves and our desire to become something more transcendent. And so in that sense, I guess he's crazy, but I kind of like his kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Sure.
And I mean, L. Ron Hubbard, there you go.
Yeah. Sorry, Cal.
He cheated.
There were a whole bunch of people in that, I believe that writer's group.
That cabal. Yes.
My friend Phyllis, who knows them all or knew them all, they were into some very odd occult stuff and invited some very odd people into their group. But I never expect, you know, asking me to say which is the craziest writer I know is a mug's game, as they say.
All right. Well, Kevin, our friend Kevin, who writes to us all the time and has submitted questions before, but this is a fun one. Hello, Mr. Glass. Mr. Glass, can you think of any scenario, either from your own speculation or from science fiction, where aliens could realistically have radically different cultures from ours? Here's what I mean. As much as I enjoy Star Trek, I'm not keen on how they seem to portray cultures in stereotypes.
Uh-huh.
Every Klingon, for example, is a warrior, was a warrior, or seems like wants to be a warrior.
Uh-huh.
I can't imagine a Klingon Albert Einstein sitting at his desk playing with equations. That'll give the Klingons warp drive someday. I can't imagine a Klingon Gregory House standing in a room full of white-coated Klingon doctors talking about differential diagnosis.
Uh-huh.
Klingon janitors, Klingon secretaries, Klingon journalists, computer programmers. None of this stuff seems plausible based on how the species is portrayed. And yet, I can't imagine a fully functioning modern society that doesn't have these things.
Uh-huh.
At least until Klingon Noonien Soong can invent robots to do this stuff for it, okay? To make a long story short, how alien can aliens really be? And that's the writer's problem, isn't it?
It really is, because, and this is a problem that we talked about a lot in writers' classes, in writers' workshops. And it always came down to the same thing is at the end of the day, you're creating was essentially a commercial product.
Mm-hmm.
If you're writing for your own pleasure, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't go anywhere. And you can hand it around to your friends and they can admire it. But if you develop a truly alien culture with truly alien values, with no intersection with human consciousness at all, and develop a concomitant language, you're stuck with the problem of explaining it to people in a way they care about because human beings are your audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always stuck inferring great alienness. And that's hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's I think of people like Arthur Clarke who posit ginormously old species that have evolved so far they have nothing in common with us.
Mm-hmm.
Babylon 5 did this too. They run across where young species were out in space, were basically dealing with people like ourselves, species like ourselves with similar values and languages and developments. And we run across these very old species. Mm-hmm. And the advice from the older, our older allies is never go there again because they're so different than you. The Uplift series has aliens that I believe the high point of their evolution is, well, the high point of their faith is to be drawn into a black hole. There's a short story that popped immediately to mind when Kevin asked the question called, what was it called? Think Like a Dinosaur, I think it was, where there's a replicator technology, a technology that beams us across space and time that we are leasing essentially from a species that does this. It doesn't actually beam you across space and time. It simply kills you. And those of you who are Breaking Bad fans might recognize this as the Badger and Skinny Pete Star Trek subplot.
Which was very fun.
Which is very funny. But actually, there is a story, not to get too Breaking Bad on your ass, but there's this completely gratuitous, wonderful subplot where these two meth heads are talking about the science, this Star Trek plot, that the strict script that he never wrote. He just has to write it down.
He was write it down, man. Then we could make it.
It's a pie-eating contest in space, which is what makes it awesome. Yeah. But the theory, but before that conversation begins, it's, no, you don't understand. The transporter basically breaks your molecules down and creates a copy of you someplace else. Mm-hmm. And so the original you dies. And there's a story where we basically lease this technology from a species and it breaks down at some point. And we have to basically kill the person who's left living on the transporter pad, because that's never supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And the people we're leasing it from don't understand what the problem is, because they don't have the concept of soul in their culture. So they have no idea why anyone would bother with worrying about killing people or dying, because that's just part of what you do. But it's these glances at cultures. Insect cultures are big. Mm-hmm. Basing alien cultures on hive minds or on hierarchical structures that are basically insectile or reptile are very big in science fiction. But there are some truly interesting encounters with aliens that happen in Heinlein. One of the first times out of the box, you encounter a group mind species. And they happen everywhere, but you can only get far enough away from John W. Campbell's basic laws for writing science fiction if you can only go so far and then your audience won't follow you any further. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's always the problem. I like the question. It's a really good question. The answer is a little more mercantile than probably Kevin wants to hear, but that's the truth as far as I know it.
Well, and I think it's how you have to write about religion too. You know,
yeah.
Jesus has to appear as a guy on a beach after death.
Yeah.
He can't appear as something that they wouldn't recognize, because that story, I mean, I'm going all Risa Aslan on your neck. Ah! The story has to have meaning for the people that are reading it. And that's why you make him a guy on a beach.
Yeah.
Broiling fish, is everybody's done that, you know. So
It's safe. It's not terrifying.
Because you're trying to say something more than, you have to get the reader to go along with you up to that point, and then you can tell the story.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with science fiction. Also, let me ask you, Driftglass.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking last night that Breaking Bad is science fiction. Ooh. By your definition.
Ooh. Well, you take the science out. Yeah.
It makes no sense.
But it's not it's not science fiction, unfortunately, in that it's all real.
Well, yeah.
But you absolutely got it right. If you take the science out of it, the whole series collapses.
The whole series collapses.
So, you know what? Science. I'm going to go with that. I am totally going to go with that. You impress me every day, Blue Guy. And I'm going to totally go with, you know what? Breaking Bad is science fiction. See? Without the science, there is no story. That is my definition. That's very, I hadn't thought about that. That's really cool.
I told you something about science fiction that you hadn't thought.
I hadn't thought about.
And happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary. Yeah. Yeah.
We've been married 2 years on Monday, the 19th. Yeah.
We've known each other a little bit longer than that.
A little bit longer than that. And known each other's writing for even longer.
Yeah.
We read each other for 3 years before we actually even started emailing each other.
Yeah.
So and then we had a long friendship before that. So it was an evolution to where we are now.
Well,
now I can tell you things about science fiction that you didn't think of.
I never even considered. Well, let me just say that part of writing anything is the act of drama. Mm-hmm. You're creating a dramatic piece that you're hoping people will continue reading past the first page. Mm-hmm. Even if you have to do something terrible on the first page to get it past the editor, you're doing something that will hopefully draw readers into it. Anybody can write a boring story, but the idea and to do drama, you have to take a character, some character, and make them change. You have to put them in conflict with something and make them change. And to do that, you have to understand the motives involved. And part of the problem with writing science fiction, this sort of gets back to Kevin's question, is it's a genre, but in crime genre, you sort of know what the telltales are. In a Western, you know what the white hat and the black hat means. You know what it means when the sheriff rides into town. Mm-hmm. You know what happens when the sheriff is shot in the first three pages. You sort of understand what the rules are. In science fiction, the rules are reinvented, if it's done well, every single story. But you still have to care about the characters, care about what they're going, and care about their motives. And if they're
And I would also argue that science fiction, probably more than any other genre, is adaptable to absorbing other genres.
Yeah.
And just using that as their trope. For instance, you and I were showing our oldest, the boy, The Matrix.
Yeah.
And we got to the shootout at the end on the roof of the building, and you said, and now it's a Western.
In the subway, yeah.
Yeah, in the subway, and now it's a
Western. It's a Western. It's absolutely a Western. And you can recognize all the conventions.
Mm-hmm. And it's a shootout, and it's a duel, and it's a, it's all the things that a Western shootout between the good guy and the bad guy should be.
And what is good, the definition of good fiction is you keep your reader turning the page. And that's, it really does boil down to that. And people can be really good academically at teaching the methods and tropes of fiction, but there are people who are just really good at that thing, and I do envy them. I'm good at that, but I'm not great. And maybe if I gave up blogging and focused on that, I would be great at it, but I don't think so. I don't think I have that thing.
Well, thank you, Driftglass, and happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary, darling.